Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chairman of the club's Humanities Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Stephen Wynn, the author of Come Back, Cuomo, he was a journalist at the San Francisco Chronicle and wrote a series of articles about this and has now written a book about it. And as everyone knows, it's a very, very entertaining look at the whole process of dealing with a dog. That's one way of putting it. So, Stephen, without further ado, welcome to the club.
Thanks so much, and thanks everyone for coming out on this cold day. I appreciate seeing you. Everyone has a book inside of them. I've been hearing that since I was a child. I think most of us have. And as someone who aspired to write books, I really longed to believe it was true. My question about it was, though, how did that happen exactly? And I think I hit on a metaphor earlier on, or a way of thinking about it, which was probably destructive and harmful, and that was it was sort of like surgery or a cesarean section. You just had to find the right place to cut and make the incision, and there the book would be pretty much fully formed, ready to come out. I don't think it really actually happens like that. I think it's more the book that you end up writing, or the books you end up writing, are the ones that are sort of alien visitations that you don't foresee. And your job is to find some way to access this alien that's living in you unexpectedly and bring it writhing to life somehow. It's never so easy as the cesarean section. I'm going to talk to you today about my book, Come Back, Cuomo, Winning the Heart of a Reluctant Dog, and how it came to be. I will be reading a bit from it here and there and do some other readings also and take your questions at the end. First, because I think it may provide some insight to how this book came to be, a little bit of sort of ancient history about me, which I think might be instructive. Like everyone, I was an English major. And between my 8-page papers on Piers the Plowman or Little Dorrit, I thought I was going to write the GAM, the great American novel, or at least a pretty decent one. But I also had a second and somewhat related love, and that was newspapers. When I was a kid, I started a hand-lettered one in my neighborhood, and I've sort of never quit since. When I was in junior high school, I was the editor of the Woodland Avenue School Press, the WASP, honest to God. And a WASPy school and newspaper it was, I can assure you. Then I was the editor of the Spree High-End at Springfield High School outside of Philadelphia where I grew up and went on to be the editor of 34th Street, which was the entertainment magazine of the Daily Pennsylvanian. So I really never got away from it. I had a brief interruption when I went off to graduate school at the University of Washington, got that out of my system, and went back and immediately went to work for a startup paper in Seattle called The Weekly. It was there that my first unforeseen alien visitation came. I was in the office one day, and my editor, who I made great efforts to avoid for the most part, was in the office also. It was just the two of us. So he had me cornered. He decided that I was sort of dogging it and I needed to work on a longer project. So the first thing he suggested was a profile of the governor of Washington State at the time, Dixie Lee Ray. Some of you may remember her. She was sort of an early pro-nukes person. I had no interest in that whatsoever. I passed on that. The second one he offered me was a profile of a family that ran the horse racing business in Seattle, the Alhadiffs. I had no interest in that, so I passed on that. And I thought, this is not going well. I'm going to have to say yes to something. So the third thing he offered me was to do a piece on Ted Bundy, who was a well-known serial killer whose career had started in Seattle. And I didn't have much interest in that either, but I thought I couldn't keep saying no to my editor, so I said, well, sure, okay. And what happened was that because of Bundy's associations in the Northwest, a woman who was at the time his friend and advocate, later to become his wife, had come to the paper where I was working and offered us access to him, which she was not doing to anyone else. There was an it was a negotiation, of course. She was hoping we were going to write a piece that would exonerate him. It didn't work out that way. But I did end up with another writer who was in Salt Lake City, where Bundy's exploits had continued after he left the Northwest. He and I ended up writing a series of stories about Bundy, and they eventually turned into my first book, actually co-written book, called Ted Bundy, the Killer Next Door. And according to the Bantam cover, it was the shocking true crime thriller of a brutal sex murderer. This was not the book that I thought I was meant to write. But I did, and had this moment where the book, because it was the first of a number of books about Bundy that was written, it got some attention, and I was on TV, and I went on tour, and I sort of felt like an author. But I also sort of felt like an imposter. I really did feel this was an alien sort of visitation. It was not the book that I intended to write at all. And I didn't really want to go into the true crime business, so the book was sort of a one-off. I mean, I really did it and sort of put it behind me, and that was kind of it for that. My real calling in journalism, what I loved doing, was writing about the arts. At The Weekly, I'd covered visual art and theater and movies and classical music and crime as well, and baseball and a few other things. But my arts writing was really what got me, indirectly, what led to me getting a job, first as a six-month fill-in replacement for the theater critic at the Chronicle, and I stayed 28 years. I loved what I did. I loved the privilege of writing about theater. I liked articulating my responses to what I was seeing night after night, and I also liked the prestige and the good seats on the aisles, too. It was fun. But without thinking about it, something else was happening to my writing. I was taking on that Olympian sort of critic's mantle that critics do, in which they, even without thinking about it, and I certainly didn't, I had taken on this kind of authoritative tone. The first person was banished from my writing. It wasn't I was delivering these judgments from on high. I think I may have even thought about this, that using the first person in criticism was a way to kind of undermine or erode your authority. If you said the play was such and such, or the performance was such and such, or the lighting was inadequate, or the scenery did this or that, then it was true in a way. Whereas if you used the first person, you were kind of hedging your bets in a way. You were making it too small of a declamation. If you just said it was so, then it was somehow. And I became a kind of voice of God in my mind. Delivering. I didn't think of it this way, but it was kind of true. And, of course, when you write for the only newspaper in town, you have a kind of power whether you like it or not. And some people really reveled in it. I thought I didn't, but I suppose I did to a certain extent. But in many ways, I'd really gotten away from the... I had a voice, I think, but it felt like a ventriloquist voice in a way. It wasn't really my voice. It was this voice of the critic that I had taken on. And it wasn't really my voice. And I think slowly over time, I mean, I became aware of it, but slowly I became dissatisfied with that, or feeling that that ventriloquism wasn't working for me so much anymore, and that part of me as a writer was not really being used or accessed. In 2002, two things happened that changed that. One was that the constantly changing the cast of players at the Chronicle changed once again when the musical chairs game started. This was several years after the Chronicle and Examiner staffs had merged, and there was going to be the first in many series of staff reductions, which continued to this day. And at that time, there were, by virtue of the staffs having merged, sort of a Noah's Ark phenomenon. There were two soccer writers and two football writers and two theater critics, of which I was one of them. And there was going to be, that was going to end, a bunch of people were going to leave the paper, and I had a choice to either, you know, try to remain as the theater critic or to do something else. So I decided it was time for a change. I had already grown sort of dissatisfied with what I was doing. So I took on this new job as arts and culture critic, which was to be a kind of cross-disciplinary job where I wrote about all the arts and wrote about them in a more... In a more personal way. That kind of developed, but more it was to be a kind of synthesizing voice where I wrote about theater and music and culture and things more broadly. And I think that started to loosen me up as a critic first, and it started to make me think about voice and how my voice and the voice of the critic might start to, which had become, I think, very separated from each other, might start to join and thread together a little more. Here's what I said about that, having left theater criticism, starting in this into the arts and culture criticism, in a talk that I gave at the Legion of Honor about criticism several years ago. A happy byproduct of my own departure from theater criticism to a more cross-disciplinary approach was that it made me think more about what I was thinking about. I grew more aware not only of my own critical processes and strategies, but of a kind of implied shared space that critics and readers occupy together. Criticism, I came to see more clearly, is only partially, and perhaps least interestingly, a matter of skillfully deployed and supported opinions. It is, intentionally or not, a projection of a sensibility and a self, what I have labeled the critical I, as in first-person I. For all the Olympian detachment and privilege that critics may seem to hold, they are, wittingly or not, revealing themselves in public as much as a poet or novelist or even a memoirist does all the time. It is the reader's response and interaction with that that finally matters more to us than whether the critic liked or disliked something, I thought. We connect to criticism, as we do to any kind of writing, in multiple ways. Yes, there's the content of the prose, the description and the argument and the assessment of whatever is being reviewed or discussed. But we also hear a voice register a larger point of view, a sense of humor, an inherent delight or distrust of the world, a political and moral stance. Think of Pope or Shaw or Hazlitt, Pauline Kael or Peter Sheldahl or Dale Peck. Here is where and how we engage critics in that space, shared space I was talking about. We are drawn to them, or sometimes repelled, folded into their way of seeing and thinking, or challenged to apprehend the world in slightly altered and sometimes even alarming ways. Well, I liked that. I liked opening up in that way. I liked thinking about the way that critics can think and connect to readers in ways that I hadn't thought about when I was simply this, deliverer of judgments, like a judge night after night. And shortly, it was around that time, I guess, I started to write a column called The Culture, in which I was licensed to really use the first person and write about my own experience more directly. And I think that started to loosen me up as a writer. I know this is a long way towards coming towards this book, but it laid the foundation, I think, for me, and it was important. The other thing that happened in 2002 was that my father died. And it was sudden and unexpected. It happened shortly after a trip that my daughter and I had taken to Southern California with my sister, my daughter's aunt. And that's relevant because after I came back from the funeral, I sat down at my desk really without thinking about where I was going with this at all and wrote a first-person piece about that. About my father's death and about what had happened on that trip to Southern California with my daughter and my sister beforehand. And what happened briefly was this. We went to a Dodgers game, and we had very good seats through a friend of a friend who had happened to have these great seats right behind the Dodgers dugout. And a player named Eric Karros hit a home run, and when he was coming back to the dugout, someone tossed him a ball from the dugout, and he pointed across the dugout. He was going down at my daughter, who was 10 years old at the time, and indicated that he was going to give her the ball. He rolled the ball across the top of the dugout to her, and she took it. It was a great moment. This was before my father's death and before anyone of us knew he was even sick particularly. And that night, we called my father and told him about it, and he got the circumstances of it all completely wrong and reported it to other people. It came out to this very bizarre story where it was sort of a Babe Ruth story where he told people that Eric Karros had told my daughter he was going to hit a home run first. I mean, it was this completely jumbled thing. And in retrospect, it was part of his, you know, his cognitive faculties starting to fade, and they went very quickly after that. Anyway, I wrote this piece, really sat down, and I never do this. I don't think I got up to get pretzels or something to drink in the middle of it. I sat there. It spilled out in this single draft. I don't know why I'd written that, and I mean, I knew why I'd written it, but I didn't know what I intended to do with it. And I happened to mention it to an editor at the paper several days later, after I came back, they knew my father had died. They welcomed me back, and I said, gee, I wrote this piece. He said, show it to us. So I did, and they ran it on Father's Day in 2002, and it was sort of a revelation to me. It was kind of my coming out, or my I guess it was the first time in 20, then would have been something like 25, 26, no, 21 years at that point, that I'd really written in my own voice as myself about my own experience. And I didn't think that was going to, you know, that was leading anywhere particularly. It was something that happened. I wrote about that experience and I moved on. I went back to writing my column and so forth. But I think I'd been opened up in two different ways by those two things. A year and a half later, in the fall of 2003, we adopted a dog. This came after my daughter, who had been lobbying for a dog since she was pre-verbal, I think, finally broke my wife and I down about it. And we went to a shelter. We came back. We were in Italy when we told her on her 12th birthday that she could have this. We were going to get her a dog when we came back to San Francisco. And we thought this was going to be easy. You just went out to a shelter and you could find this adorable dog anywhere and it would be just this wonderful, smooth process. Not so. Anyone who's ever tried to adopt a dog knows. We found, you know, one after another, you know, kind of violent pit bulls and sort of shady mutts of various kinds, dogs. There was a dog mill over in Oakland that was really scary. Anyway, we continued searching for this dog. And we found what I thought was the absolutely ideal dog at this shelter in Redwood City. Her name was Ecstasy. And her principal virtue was that she was basically immobile. She kind of sat in her cage and breathed and looked like a dog, but I thought this would be perfect. We could bring her home and just sort of place her in the living room floor, and she would just be this kind of, you know, model dog. My daughter wanted no part of this dog. That was not the dog she had. I thought it was ideal. But anyway, our search continued, and we ended up going back to the same shelter a month or 6 weeks later. I forget, something like that. My wife had seen this kind of cute-looking terrier mutt's face on the webpage, a dog named Gandalf. And we picked up our daughter at school and said, we got to hurry down there because these dogs go fast. So we go down there to the same shelter again, and we're directed to where this dog is, and it bore no resemblance to the image on the web page. This dog was either huddled and hunched against the back cage wall or leaping up against the front page over and over again, the front cage, over and over again, like sort of on a pogo stick or something. Looked like a cross between a kind of starved coyote and some sort of a rat or something. Very unpromising dog. That was the dog for Phoebe. That was the dog she absolutely had to have. So we went upstairs to the visiting room where the dog was introduced to us, and all he was doing was circling the room sort of in a panic, looking for a way out. Phoebe was completely smitten with this dog. I don't know what she saw. I certainly didn't see it. But before I knew it, this very skillful woman who worked at the shelter had sort of kind of basically sold us on this dog. We went back downstairs and learned that, first of all, this dog had been adopted once and returned. Second of all, that he hated men. And third of all, that he was a very skillful escape artist. But by then the deal was struck, and we took this dog home. And for the first 3 or 4 days, we had just an absolute nightmare experience with this dog, all of which is detailed in the book. He chewed his way out of the crate that we put him through. He escaped from the house repeatedly, always on my watch. When Sally and Phoebe, my wife Sally and Phoebe, and my daughter Phoebe were in the house, they could get him on a leash. He was fine with them. He was getting used to them. He wouldn't come near me. So when it was time for me to get him on the leash, and I was the only one in the house, had to take him out for a walk, I had to either lie down on the bed for long periods and await him to approach, or even work better if I was on the toilet and he found me absolutely passive and, you know, not threatening, and then he might come close enough to. So anyway, all these things were happening, and one thing right after another. One day at work, I usually like to work at home, but now I found going to work was very preferable, and get away from the house. So I was having lunch with a friend who was not my editor, but an editor at the paper. Her name is Wendy Miller. And I was telling her these stories about what had happened, what was going on with the dog, really just kind of unburdening myself of these things. And once again, this was not something that I thought about writing about at all, but she did. And as we were lunching together, she reached into her purse. It was down on the floor beside her on the chair. I can still see this very clearly. Plucked her cell phone out of the purse, opened it, and dialed the features editor of the paper and said, "Stephen Wynn is telling me these hilarious stories about a dog. He's got to write him for the newspaper." And I had my club sandwich in my hand. I think my mouth stayed open for, 20 seconds while I was... We didn't talk about this. Anyway, I took my orders from the editor and indeed started writing about the dog. And I think while I was surprised by this and did not see it coming, in some ways, because of those things that had happened, one, that I was writing criticism in a sort of more loose-jointed and personal way, and two, that I'd written this piece about my father, it sort of laid the groundwork for it in some ways. So I agreed to do this, and I ended up writing what was a kind of a three-part series that ran in September we'd adopted the dog, and the first stories didn't really run until the new year, until January. And they were three stories about adopting the dog and deciding to keep him. One thing the shelter had also told us was that there was a 30-day return policy, that if things didn't work out, the shelter would take the dog back with no questions asked, and sometimes the matches weren't right. I was rooting for that right from the start. And so it was there was sort of a cliffhanger quality to it, and there were these various episodes that happened. There's much more that happened in those early days. And I kind of left it at that. In my mind, I was still writing for a newspaper. I wasn't thinking about a book at all at this point. These were stories that were self-contained, that had a beginning and an end. Some of them had a little window opening into the next story, particularly. But you could have stopped reading any of them. And these stories, by the way, went on for a period of several years, where periodically things would happen with the dog and I would write another episode. And the dog always was, provided new material. That was not a problem. But I want to read to you something from one of these pieces. This is actually from several years on. This is from 2006, so we'd had the dog for going on 3 years by then. And I want to read you the kind of thing that I wrote in the newspaper. Again, still thinking that this was not a book in the making. I was a newspaper man. I was a columnist. I was writing pieces that were self-contained and that worked in their own right. This is a piece that ran in June of 2006 and began like this. He might have been there for a while by the time I noticed him, 10 minutes, 15, maybe longer. I'd been reading on the couch since dinner, lost in my book. My wife, Sally, was at the back of the house in the study, and our daughter, Phoebe, upstairs in her room. Our dog, Como, who has openly and unambiguously preferred their company to mine since we adopted him from a shelter going on 3 years ago, just about never lingers in my vicinity, especially if either Sally or Phoebe is available. Como and I meet, for the most part, when our paths happen to cross. His uncoerced visits to me are rare. But there he was, stretched out on the living room rug with no one else around. Glancing up at the end of a chapter, I saw him and pondered his presence. Did he think it was time for me to fulfill my customary obligation and take him out on his last walk of the day? Usually, since it was hours too early for a ritual that invariably begins with my pleading and shaking his leash enticingly, was he hinting around for one of the treats that I occasionally, cravenly offer as a token of my devotion? That didn't figure either. Groveling was my role, not his. Was Phoebe's bedroom door shut to him and the rest of us, as it sometimes is now that she's in high school and requires the purification rites of parental isolation? Had Sally slipped into the backyard for some nocturnal pruning and left Como momentarily bereft? Was he sick? No, he was just there, and of his own free will, serene and seemingly content, if not exactly or even remotely companionable. Positioning himself on a corner of the rug as far away from the couch and me as possible, he was gazing off in the opposite direction. There was something studied, almost stagey, about his posture, the implacable set of his shoulders, the blithe back tilt of his ears, his thick white tail flung across the carpet at me like an arrow. I felt simultaneously flattered and challenged. He'd made the first move. The next one was up to me. Softly and as warmly as I could manage, I called his name, phrasing it like an inviting, open-ended question. Como? Como? Como, can you come? I was glad neither Sally or Phoebe was within earshot. Masters of the decisive summons, my wife and daughter can each command the dog's response with a crisp, Como, come, that sends him trotting, if not sprinting, to them. My wheedling would have sounded pathetic to them, as it did to me, but this was a chance, a rare opportunity to forge new ground between us. I wasn't about to let a little man of the house pride get in the way. Como, como, come on, boy, come, come on, como, come. I was getting tongue-tied, also a little hoarse from my falsetto begging and slightly impatient and annoyed as well. Hadn't this dog put us, and especially me, through enough torment? A determined and apparently traumatized escape artist when we first adopted him, he had gnawed his way out of the cage, shredded carpets and doors, and escaped from the house twice on my watch. The second escape, as Home and Garden readers might recall from previous chapters of these Como Chronicles, ended when he scooted under the front wheel of a moving SUV. The amount of the subsequent surgery and vet hospital bills, which we gradually paid at the time, is still too painful to print or even speak out loud. I'm not saying all this was going through my head as I lay there hoping that Como might at least turn his head and acknowledge me with one of his withering, over-the-shoulder looks. But it's also true that our long and labored history, is never entirely absent from my mind. In some small way, almost every day, Como reminds me where I stand with him. And there he was doing it again, in an inspired new way, by waltzing into the room of his own accord and then pointedly snubbing me. The realization landed on me an instant before he did. My God, I thought, this damn dog has been putting me on all along. He's been playing... I'm sorry, I skipped a chapter. I'm not sure if I actually spoke the words that came into my head next or merely thought them as I picked up my book again. Either way, Como responded instantly. No sooner was to hell with you out of my mouth or mind than he spun around, took two galloping strides across the rug, and launched himself onto the low coffee table in front of me and onto my chest. The realization landed on me an instant before he did. My God, I thought, this damn dog has been putting me on all along. Maybe so, but in that astonishing moment when Como was sailing across the living room at me, I felt a shiver of something beyond ordinary comprehension. Oof, I said, when his feet digging into my midsection and his head thudding against my jaw, he felt like he'd been dropped on me from a very great height. Suddenly, after 1,000-odd days in our house, Como had pulled a completely new trick out of his bag. He had amazed me and brought me up short and made me grunt and laugh out loud with the sheer airborne surprise of what he'd just done. Well, I read this again the other night when I was looking through these things, and I thought sort of several things about it. That, on the one hand, it feels like it might be a book. It feels like it might be a scene from a book. It maybe had more heft to it and more sort of novelistic detail than I really thought. But I was also aware of what I had to do with each one of these pieces, and that was kind of backfill and narrate what had happened already on the assumption that people hadn't read the columns before. So in a way, I was kind of tricking myself. I was still writing columns that had certain requirements of a newspaper piece. You have to be able to read it. It has to have the backstory. It has to have all of those. It has to have all of those things going on. So even as people were telling me and insisting that there was a book in this series, that now there were now probably 8 or 10 pieces that had run, I really didn't see it. I didn't. I just didn't see how the book was going. I couldn't quite, even though I was writing in the first person and writing in this more personal way, I couldn't quite see how that was going to make the next step. I was still a newspaper person at heart, even if I was writing and doing it in a different way. Then in the spring of 2008, when I started to feel that my days at the Chronicle were numbered, or maybe that the Chronicle's days were numbered, I started to think about, maybe I really did need to think about this, that maybe there really was a book here and that I need to sort of free myself from the last vestiges of being rooted in the newspaper and writing in that way about it. So I tried several things. The first thing I did was to write another. I hadn't written about Como for a while, so I wrote another story for the Chronicle. It's nice to have a newspaper that you can sort of road test material, and if you've been there long enough, And the paper was always very receptive to these pieces. And so I wrote another one to see if I still sort of had it in my fingers. It had probably been 6 or 8 months since I'd written one. And that one felt fine, and that worked. And then I really kind of decided I would have to call my bluff. And so I wrote a chapter of what would be a possible Como book. And this was material that lay completely outside of anything I'd written before. It was the chapter about us going to the shelter in Redwood City and encountering ecstasy. And that is now the first chapter of the book. There's a prologue, and that's now the first chapter of the book. And so that when that worked, I remember feeling a kind of a sort of pit in the stomach. I called my bluff and sort of answered it. I said, okay, now I've really got to take the next step. I proved myself. But it was important to do that, I think, because I think I had to kind of prove it to myself. I had to finally pull that root, that newspaper root out of the ground and shake it off and say, okay, this is a different way to think about this material. This is a different approach. This is a book with a longer, different arc, a whole different kind of architecture to it. And after that worked, and I didn't show it to anyone, I just kind of kept that silent. And I did feel sort of almost frightened, because I thought, well, this is probably going to mean I'm going to need to leave the paper. I didn't see how I could keep working my job and doing that, which I was ready to do, but was I really ready to do it? So I continued with the experiment and wrote what I knew I would need to do next, was to write a book proposal, which, as anyone who's ever tried to write a book knows, writing a book proposal is actually much harder than writing the book. Because what you have to do there is you're both explaining, laying out what the book will be in some detail, and also pitching it to a potential publisher. You're really saying not only what it is, but why it's essential this book should be published. How does it compare to other books in the market? How is it different? How is it the same? How does it where does it fit in the marketplace, which most writers are just making this stuff up and guessing. And then you have to also write an outline of what the whole book would be. So you really have to kind of build the scaffold for the thing before you've ever started to put anything up on it. They're very tricky to do. They're very hard to do. And I avoided doing it for a long time, but I'd kind of called my bluff, so I continued. And meanwhile, my agent, a woman who turned out to be my agent, Amy Rennert, who was I'd known for years. She used to be the editor of what was then called Focus Magazine, and I'd done some writing for her back then. She'd been bugging me about this for several years, saying, where's that Como book? Where's that Como book? So I finally showed her what I had. We did some refining on it, and we started to send it out. And it was right around that time that unexpectedly the Chronicle offered buyouts. And it felt like it had my name on it. So I jumped, and, things happened. Luckily for me, we had some turndowns for the book right away, and I was beginning to think, what have I done? I've put myself out there, and what's next for me? But we were lucky enough to have an offer from HarperCollins, and the book was written quickly because Harper wanted to have it out in the fall, this fall. I started writing it last December, and the book was published this October, and it all feels like it happened very quickly. Now, I could spend a long time on the sausage-making process of what it's like for a book to actually come out. It's not all pretty. It's exciting, and it's fun in many ways, but there are a lot of hair-raising aspects to it, things that it's fun, but strange, particularly now with publishing sort of melting down. I mean, just briefly, one thing that did happen to me, HarperCollins is a company under which there are a number of imprints. William Morrow is a HarperCollins imprint. Harper One, which is published in San Francisco, is a Harper imprint. HarperCollins, these various, there's a children's book series. So I actually had signed with an imprint called Collins. And 2 months into the writing of the book, I got an email one day from my editor, who we'd been back and forth with pleasantly about editing some of the early book. And the subject line of her email said, "One last thought." And it was about something that we were going back and forth about, something in the second chapter. Well, it turned out to be really her last thought. She was fired the next day. The Collins imprint was closed. And for about 24 hours, I didn't have a publisher. Harper, another imprint, picked it up and things proceeded. But like a lot of people in publishing at that time, she got caught in the downdraft. So, I mean, those are the kind of things that everybody who publishes a book goes through, editors getting fired and things changing in midstream and so forth. But I think, you know, for the more interesting thing for me was how was what I had written already going to serve or misserve what I wanted to write, because I knew that the book was, well, first of all, it was going to be, you know, substantially longer than the series, which I think a lot of people, including my publisher, didn't quite grasp. They sort of thought they'd bought this series and you could just kind of, you know, pack it in, or, you know, fill it out a little bit here and there. And I think I thought that too at first. I thought, well, I've kind of told the story about this dog over the months, but what that didn't prove to be true at all, really. The series that I had written, again, still had that sort of newspaper rootedness to them. And when I first sat down to write, I printed out all the stories, and I thought, well, this is going to be really helpful. I'm going to be able to consult them. And for the first, really not very long, maybe the first 10 days or 2 weeks maybe, I would look at the series, and increasingly I stopped doing that altogether. It was sort of a cognitive dissonance. What I'd written in the newspaper, even though it was about the episodes that had happened to us with the dog, and even though it had some of the kind of detail that I wanted to get into the book, it was a different animal, so to speak. It was something that, it was episodic, it was serial, the stories were self-contained, and it didn't have the bigger arc to it that I wanted this book to have or to be. I wanted it to be about, not just about a dog and not just about our episodes with the dog, but really about what happened to us as a family over time, what happened to me, what happened to my relationship with my wife, what happened as my daughter grew up. She was 12 when we got the dog, and she's left for college by the time the book is over, is just getting ready to leave for college. So there were these sort of longer arcs that I wanted to draw, and I found that the series was really kind of blurring that or making that difficult or in a way interfering with it. So it was an odd kind of challenge to both tell a story I'd already told and at the same time kind of detach from that story and try to find a different arc for it. So for example, the episode that I just read you from the newspaper series is not in the book at all. It felt, I love the story and I love what happened that night. It felt like a bubble. It felt self-contained. It didn't feel like it had fingers or connective tissue to the rest of the story that I wanted to tell now. So there are things in the series, even though the series was about 12 or 14,000 words, a lot of it I actually scuttled. There was another whole episode I wrote about, really about the word fine, which is a word that my in-laws use in a very subtle and complex way. When they say something is fine, they mean a whole range of things. And it was about the dog also, and that isn't in the book at all. And in fact, there is one sentence in the series that appears in the book, word for word, a sentence I'm particularly fond of. And that was it. Otherwise, the book is it's a complete repurposing of the material, a complete reshaping of the material, a completely different book. And I want to read you a section from the book to sort of illustrate what I'm talking about. This is something I've actually never read out loud before, because it occurs sort of farther into the book. Usually when I'm doing a reading, I read something early on in the book that sort of sets the stage and talks about, you know, our first encounters with the dog. But this is, I hope, illustrates how far away from that, in a way, this book tries to move and how it really became a very sort of different thing. This is late in the book, and there's two things you should know before I read you this passage. One is that Como has, by the time of the action of this chapter, has acquired a nickname, Z. And that's explained. There's a chapter devoted to that in the book, so I won't try to explain it here now. And the other thing is, as was mentioned in the series, that Como had survived a serious accident by the time of this episode. So if I can find where I am here. Phoebe was zipping through high school. loving her classes, well, most of them, her new friends, social freedoms, and mobility. With a Muni fast pass plucked from her wallet, she could get anywhere she wanted to go on San Francisco's abundant bus and streetcar lines. The car rides to her friend Jeannie's house, the Stonestown Mall, Mel's drive-in, or downtown to a movie that Sally and I sometimes grumbled about giving were now rarely requested. Even Berkeley and Oakland were within easy striking range on the BART trains that speed under San Francisco Bay. One afternoon, I picked up the phone and heard a staticky blur of teenage chatter, laughter, and some oddly distinct and inventive swearing. The sound of glassware was also involved. Phoebe, is that you? She developed the maddening habit of placing these check-in calls to us on her cell phone and then, apparently regarding the duty as such an empty obligation, falling into conversation with a friend and neglecting to respond when we answered. Phoebe? Phoebe? Dad, for God's sake, stop yelling. Sheesh. Well, you're not talking to me. I'm talking now. What do you want me to say? It was amazing, almost impressive, how quickly she could be annoyed by Sally or me, as if our very existence were an affront to her. Where are you? Jax. Who's Jack? You know, Jack. I didn't know, but decided not to pursue it. When are you coming home? Wait, hold on. The background rabble was muffled as she held the phone to her arm or shoulder, I'd seen her do it, and spoke to someone else. What? She said, returning to the line with that master teenage touch of stalling for time before abruptly cutting it short. I don't know. I'll call you later. Bye. What was that? Sally called out from the kitchen. Was that our girl? What'd she say? Nothing, I said. Really nothing. I'm taking Como to the beach. My trips to Ocean Beach with Como tend to be spontaneous. Sometimes I take him first thing in the morning, often as a procrastination tactic if I have a writing assignment. Late afternoons are also good, when the sun becomes a glowing brass disc dropping into the Pacific Ocean like a precious coin. Thick fogs are frequent in the city's western edge. When the mood is right, a blurry, wet scrim gives the surf an enticingly eerie appeal. There's something about ruminating when you can't see 10 feet in front of you that can make even the most insubstantial thought seem broodingly profound. Como hopped down from the back seat, primed to hit the sand. Hold on, I nagged, pulling him closer to my side. Crossing the Great Highway always makes me a little edgy. After the accident, Como and cars became and remained an unwelcome combination. Go for it, Z, I said when the roadway cleared and the green walk sign came on. Slapping along in my sandals, I raced him down to the soft slope. I raced him down the soft slope and onto the expansive plain of Ocean Beach sand that stretches from the Cliff House at the north end to Fort Funston at the south. Como and I have distinct but workably parallel ideas of a walk on the beach, what a walk on the beach entails. I like to shed my sandals or shoes and splash along in the ankle-deep water. He prefers not to get his paws wet. Linked by a 26-foot retractable leash, we can each have our own way. I just have to make sure the leash doesn't trip anyone walking or jogging along the shoreline, and that I spot Como before he rolls in some foul-smelling seaborne gunk and yank him away. Otherwise, I'm free to let my wine wander and forget how far we've walked. Off the city's grid of streets and blocks and tightly spaced buildings, distance and time open out. For the first few hundred yards that day, I replayed my phone call with Phoebe, coached myself on not getting frazzled and worried that we were losing touch with her. Then I reminded myself that nothing Sally and I thought about Phoebe one minute was necessarily true the next. Yes, she could be shockingly dismissive and rude to us, but she was also tender and affectionate, needy and kind. Approaching 15, she still nuzzled in between Sally and me on our bed to watch television and still liked to be tucked in at night, at least on the nights when she hadn't slammed her door to us early in the evening. She still showed us her English and history papers, sometimes, and cared what we thought, sometimes. She still called us Mommy and Daddy, if she wasn't whispering some other names under her breath. Sally and I had wanted a second child. Our failure to conceive again and our decision not to adopt pried open some painful, wrenching fissures in the early years of our marriage. We were disappointed in ourselves and in our biological bad luck. We blamed the doctors when the fertility treatments didn't work. We blamed each other, privately and sometimes not, for waiting too long, for not having gotten together sooner, for our ambivalence about adoption, and for the guilt we had felt about it. Then, when it really was too late, we gradually stopped blaming and started being more thankful for what we had. in each other, in our delightful and exasperating daughter, our friends, our families, our work lives, our anxious, ambivalent dog who didn't die. I felt a tug on the leash. Koma had his feet planted in the sand to scrutinize an impressive sandcastle fitted out with sand dollar shields around its base and surrounded by a sagging moat. Usually it was something either repulsive and smelly or mysteriously inconsequential that snagged his attention. This time he'd found something of genuine general interest. "Hey, that's pretty cool," someone said. It was a surfer heading out toward the breakers. "Did he build it himself?" "He wouldn't let me help," I said, playing along. "He's very particular." The surfer nodded. "What's his name?" "Como," I said, "but we call him Z." No explanation was required by the man in the shiny black wetsuit. There's a free-floating, come-what-may feel to things out at the beach. Encounters that might seem peculiar elsewhere come off as perfectly natural here. "Later," said the surfer, who turned and sprinted out into the water with his board tucked under his arm. Como looked up from the castle and watched him go. Z and I have a number of similar chance meetings on the beach. A small collector stopped to remark on how much Como... a shell collector stopped to remark on how much Como resembles a dog she had once had in Ireland. A tiny, wide-eyed child got down on his knees in the wet sand and waited patiently for my wary dog to come close enough to be petted, while his father and I talked about preschools. An old man ignored Como altogether and speculated on the contents of a container ship on the horizon. "What breed is he, or she?" a woman dressed in a hooded sweatshirt and red and white striped tights asked me one morning. Her large black sheepdog mix circled around us. "He," I said, "terrier mutt." "Don't ever say that," the woman scolded me. "Mutt is a horrible, insensitive, mean thing to call any dog." Off she stalked with her sheep-a-doodle or whatever his precise and proper designation was. You have to take it all as it comes. People are nutty, nostalgic, reverent, obsessive, occasionally cruel, adoring, and doctrinaire when it comes to dogs. Somehow that's also plainly, bracingly apparent out there on the beach, whether it's some serious runner charging along with a leash held firmly in hand, a couple fussing over their beagle, or a boy flinging a dripping wet tennis ball as far as he can, and a German shepherd vaulting over the foam-lipped waves in pursuit. I'd walked farther than I meant to that day. "Come on, Z," I said, reversing directions and checking my watch. As we started the trek back to the car, I realized that these trips to Ocean Beach weren't really what I thought they were. I always came out planning to be alone with my thoughts, and more often than not, wound up feeling a little less alone. We were about to start back up the slope to cross the Great Highway when Como found a long strand of bright green kelp, as thick and slimy as a snake. I was in a hurry. I had work to do, but I caught myself before I pulled him away. "Go for it, Z," I told him. "That may be the shiniest, best piece of kelp you ever find." Well, in some ways, I realized that by the end of this story, Como is not the center of attention. He's kind of a supporting player in our life. And that's the story I really wanted to tell. And it was a long path to get there, and it took really writing the book to realize what book I was actually writing. I didn't entirely know that when I set out to do that. But it remains interesting when I think back. Because it happened so quickly, I can sort of see this with some clarity. That newspaper series wasn't that long ago. And to get from there to the book that I hope that I've written, that I think that I've written, was, in another way, a kind of alien visitation. Thank you all. Happy for questions.
Thanks so much, Stephen. That was just great. So if you have any questions, you can hand them to Ellen if you want to write them down. If you want to ask them personally, that's fine too. You just have to do it into the microphone because it's being recorded. So we have at least a few questions, and one of the first ones is extremely practical and not about the arc of your story at all, but based on your experience with Como, what would you look for before adopting another dog?
Don't adopt one like him. No, actually, that's not true at all. I mean, this dog has been absolutely a delight. I mean, a challenge in many ways, but a transformative experience for all of us in our family. So I suppose I recommend, adopting the most difficult dog you can possibly find. I think what's important and what Phoebe saw about this dog and what she connected to was that she felt something about this dog. and she felt nothing about ecstasy, and lots of the other dogs that we saw as well. So I think, like anything, like any relationship, you should feel something about the dog. You should feel some connection, and that's what you should look for. It's going to be difficult one way or another, probably, and in unpredictable ways as well.
I'd like to remind everyone that we're here listening to Stephen Wynn at the Commonwealth Club, talking about the process of writing his book, Come Back Homo. Well, next question. Would you like to write for Hollywood, and have you done so already, and is this on your agenda?
Yeah. Sure. Who doesn't want those big Hollywood checks, right? Actually, my first alien visitation was optioned by Paramount, and I had one of those surreal meetings in Hollywood that people have where you go down there, you're shown into some producer's office that's lined with books that surely have never been opened and may not even be books themselves. And they tell you how brilliant you are, what a genius you are, and you never hear from them again. So that was my experience in Hollywood.
And would you like to repeat it?
Maybe, well, sure, yes. I'll have a meeting like that again. That sounds, it was fun.
What? Unless you understand that, I don't understand that one.
I don't understand.
Okay. I thought maybe there was something in the book that I missed. All right. What is the biggest thing you feel guilty about in your relationship with Cuomo?
Oh. Probably lost it. Well, I mean, he was run over on my watch. He had made a number of escapes from the house, and this particular one ended when he was run over. What happened was the house was being worked on at the time, and his dislike of men played out in this particular way. He fled from the house. They left the door just a tiny bit open. He slipped out and was out on the street, and there was a guy working out in front who was dealing with the dumpster out front. He was sort of packing the trash down, and as I learned later, this man had a dog himself that he and his son had watched this dog get run over. His son had seen this dog get killed, and this guy who was working on our house, immediately plugged into that or whatever, and he said, I can catch him, and I didn't let him do it because I thought, I didn't think I could catch him, but I thought surely he's not going to let this stranger catch him, whatever. And I'll bet that guy could have caught him and Cuomo wouldn't have been run over. So I suppose I feel guilty about that and guilty about having, somehow let Cuomo down and nearly let him die.
And the operations, you mentioned about the operations and everything, and how long did it take him to recover?
Well, he almost didn't make it because they tried three different times to operate on him. And one time, we've sort of found this out afterwards, his lungs filled with blood from the anesthetic, and they had to stitch him back up again and wait a number of days after that. So it was about 6 days total till he could be operated on. And then, of course, being who he is, he was supposed to be confined into a cage for 6 weeks or something while his pelvis healed. Well, this dog doesn't like cages, to put it mildly. So we had to abandon that process early on. He ended up sleeping on Phoebe's on the floor in Phoebe's room for his recuperation period.
Well, here's an interesting question. How much money have you spent on Cuomo's teeth, or has his chewing up everything kept them strong?
Well, when he chewed his way out of this, it was a very heavy-duty crate with these plastic hinges, and the first night he was in the house, he chewed his way right through it. We took the crate back to the pet store where we bought it, and the people in the pet store sort of took a step back for us and said, what kind of animal did you have? And they said it was they thought it was like a mini panther or something. And I said, a terrier or whatever. I said, have you looked at his teeth? And indeed, this is a history of his. He's apparently chewed on things. His teeth are quite worn down. So it's a good thing he did. I suppose it doesn't matter that he doesn't bite, because if he did, they're not particularly sharp. But yes. But I, about teeth, I just learned this the other day, in fact, that in order to have a dog's teeth clean, you have to put them under an anesthetic because they need to be knocked out, which I didn't know and we're sort of loath to do. So,
Another practical question. Are the articles for the Chronicle series online available so that you could read the...
They are online. If you go to SFGate and sort of tap around a little bit, I actually found them myself, which is how I pulled this up. I think you go to the most... There was one in 2008, and it has all of the other articles. There are links to all the other articles there. So, yes, you can find them online, yes. And, better you should read the book, though.
I was going to make that suggestion, too. Now, this is an impractical question. When Comeback Cuomo is made into a movie, who will play you and who will play Cuomo?
Yeah, Cuomo certainly wouldn't play himself. I don't think he'd do very well on a Hollywood set. We have a friend who's been casting the movie ever since we started writing the book. I'm apparently to be played by Kevin Kline. The resemblance is unmistakable. And my wife is to be played by Annette Bening, which I particularly like because I reviewed Annette Bening in her first professional shows way back here in the early 80s. So if that were to happen, it's very likely to happen. So, you know.
And it would certainly make your wife happy.
Yes, exactly.
We have time for just maybe one or maybe two more questions. With all the lofty, thought-provoking arts and culture pieces you wrote for the Chronicle, why do you think your readers responded so strongly to the Cuomo pieces? Is it the first person? Is it that this is your true voice rather than your authoritarian voice?
I suppose I don't know the answer to that. I do know that almost anything about a dog draws a certain kind of avid response from readers, so there is that. But I hope that the latter is true, that there is something in the voice and maybe a broader and more. I know there were some people in the theater community who were thrilled to see me humiliated by the dog. That was insane. Some of them I actually heard from. It's about time you got your comeuppance from. So there may have been that sort of perverse revenge motive also. I'm not sure.
Schadenfreude animates way too much,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
All right. Do you think that not knowing what the story was about, or at least how it would come out in the end, helped make it a better book?
That's a great question. I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that writing a book is finding out what book you're writing. I think it's true about any piece of writing. I mean, it was true for me when I was writing reviews all the time. People would say, what did you think about the show? They'd say it at intermission, and it sounded disingenuous, but I would say, I honestly don't really know until I write the review. And I think it's true about any piece of writing that you didn't know. I mean, I certainly didn't know that scene on the beach was coming when I started writing the book. I mean, books develop, any piece of writing develops a momentum and a kind of vector about it, and it goes somewhere, and to a certain extent, you follow it. And I think that was true in this. It's true, and I think it's true in all. It's why writing is so fascinating and endlessly renewable, because you are constantly finding out what you think.
And for the final question, one that all authors want to hear, what's your newest book going to be about?
Yeah, to be continued. I don't know. I'm thinking about a few things. I don't think there's another Cuomo book in me, though.
So. Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for a great talk about the process of writing. And we also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this either online or on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 150th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.